From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
The president's expressed concern since this Obama policy came into effect, but he's also voiced that this is a very expensive and disruptive policy, and based on consultation that he's had with his national security team, came to the conclusion that it erodes military readiness and unit cohesion.
The United States Army is open to all Americans who meet the standard, regardless of who they are.
McCain waves his hand to get the attention of the Senate clerk, pauses for just a moment, and gives a dramatic thumbs down.
Yes, the White House said, the president was involved in the crafting of a misleading statement that initially obscured the true nature of his son Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer during the campaign.
The revolving door at the White House is spinning faster. Anthony Scaramucci is out of a job only 10 days after being named White House Communications Director. This happened hours after John Kelly was sworn in as the new chief of staff.
Yes, that all happened in 1 week. You can join our conversation 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us to talk about the week's news is Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning.
Christine Stort is here, editor-in-chief at ctnewsjunkie.com. Hi there, Christine.
Hi, John.
And Dan Haar, who covers commerce, economics, wealth, and poverty. He's a columnist for the Hartford Current. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
So, Colin, there's so much to choose from. This is one of those weeks where I'm just going to let you choose what's the topic we want to start with. It's been a week that started right here when we were sitting here with this transgender military ban that came out in a series of tweets. We all just realized we should open up Twitter in the background so we know if some other policy pronouncement is made during the course of this hour. I don't know. Where do we start?
Well, I don't know where we start either, although I guess I would say that there's two problems with the Donald Trump presidency. One of them is that it's chronically dysfunctional, and the other one is that it's occasionally functional. And so when it's functional, the places that it's functional tend to be kind of undocumented. I mean, Scott Pruitt is over there at the EPA just ripping the environment apart. You know, you don't really read so much about that. So you tend to read more about dysfunction. But this dysfunction is the main storyline right now, and the weakness of this presidency. This is a president who, in the case of the healthcare debate, got about as publicly involved in a bill as I think I've ever seen a president be. I mean, usually presidents are very involved in bills that they care about, but not in a way that you know about. They're not like, you know, bumping up against the equivalent of Mitch McConnell, you know, to be ringmaster. And that's what's happened there. He has just put his shoulder into this as hard as he possibly could. And he came up short. He also just did have this extraordinary week that included a speech to the Boy Scouts, which the Boy Scouts eventually had to apologize for, a speech about law enforcement in which he appeared to endorse kind of routine police brutality in a way that made most police organizations in America profoundly uncomfortable. It's like every time he wants to talk tough, which is kind of the thing that he likes to do the most, I mean, when he's getting resistance, the transgender thing, encountering resistance not only from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who didn't know last Wednesday that this was coming, but also think it runs counter to A, the process of changing something, and B, their overall philosophy. Every time he tries to exhibit this kind of alpha male stuff that is very much his brand, he's running into an awful lot of resistance. And I know we'll be talking about Jeff Flake in just a little while, too, but it can't continue to go like this. We tend to imagine him as this kind of autocrat who wants his way and gets his way, but that's not the way the reality is playing out.
Of course, the news this week that General John Kelly was going to step in, take over for Reince Priebus as the chief of staff, one of the threads of coverage seemed to be, well, here is a respected former general, someone who is going to get this administration back on track. I'll say, Colin, it kind of played a little bit more to me like another character that swoops into Game of Thrones to take over for a tiny bit. It seems more like a plot twist than something that can actually have any sort of real outcome. I don't know that John Kelly or anybody else changes the course of how this White House is going to be run.
Well, he could. It's unlikely. So, I mean, first of all, in general, this is a really complicated job, chief of staff. It's hard to do it well. There's a group of people who can do it well. Generals have only done it twice. John Kelly's the second one. Al Haig is the first one. I don't think any other generals ever done it. It's a more complicated set of cross currents. You know, there isn't as clear a chain of command sometimes, particularly In this case, when actual relatives of the president have functioning roles in the government and can presumably get around anybody. But the chain of command is less clear, and you are constantly balancing various countervailing interests all the time. It's an extraordinarily difficult job to do well. The Republicans have produced a lot of people who do it well. They have this kind of Shaolin monk warrior cast that includes people like James Baker, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney. I mean, these are people who have been very, very good at this job. Whether Kelly's going to be good at it or not is a jump ball, I think. The reason that he's there, or one of the main reasons I think that he's there, is everybody here in this room can name some things where, like, Rex Tillerson is a little off the reservation with Trump, you know? Same with Mattis, same with McMaster. We all know things, ways in which some of Trump's key appointees, the ones that he really appears to like and care about, differ from him. It's harder to do that with Kelly. Kelly kind of went down the line on a lot of this stuff, including, you know, you didn't really hear him squeaking about the immigration stuff, and he was the one who had to carry that ball. So I think one reason that he's there is that Donald Trump looked around and said, who has been pretty consistently loyal to me? Who has not, as far as I can tell, leaked stuff to undermine me? That's, of course, their current obsession. And who has not publicly undermined me? And Kelly's name rose to the top.
Rose to the top. So, Chris, go ahead.
I think that we are going to see some changes. You know, it might be a plot twist for a short period of time or a longer period of time, but I think that with John Kelly there in the White House, I think things have already changed. You know, literally the door to the Oval Office has now been closed. So where people were able to freely walk in and out and you know, grab Trump and talk to him about things, even while meetings were going on, that door has now been closed. And I think that there's going to be a little bit tighter access to him.
The big impact that a lot of people paid attention to, of course, is the very brash and loudmouth former communications director, Anthony Scaramucci, who served for 10 days. I know, Christine, you and your job, you've dealt with an awful lot of press flacks, people who are supposed to represent those in power. Ever seen anything quite like the short reign of Anthony Scaramucci?
No, it was like whiplash. What? He's here and now he's gone. I hardly knew you. You know, but at the same time, it's understandable in that his personality is so much like Trump's personality. And that, you know, there was a joke or somebody said to somebody in confidence, you know, if he was 7 inches taller, that he wouldn't be in this position because he would be bigger than Trump was. So there was a clash there.
That's a story that Scaramucci was shopping yesterday.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, he was saying that Trump had said that to him.
Well, we did have Joe Cohen under the Weicker administration who was pretty out there defending the nuclear waste dump in East Windsor, I believe. Was it East Windsor or Ellington?
I can't believe you remember something like that.
It happens. I want to go back and disagree with something Colin said about
Please.
The president. I don't agree that he had his shoulder to the wheel on Obamacare repeal and replace and replete and all that stuff. I think that the problem in that situation was he did not lead with any ideas. All he did was posture. And at that level of operation, you need to actually come to the table with something that you say, this is what we want to do. And Donald Trump didn't have anything that he wanted to do on that. All he wanted to do was bash people. And that, as he's learning, doesn't lead to results. I think when you look at the chief of staff, he represents discipline. And that's great. Discipline in respect to behavior, if you can rein in the president's behavior, then, you know, that's great. But it doesn't get us anywhere in terms of ideas, actual ideas coming out of the White House, which I think oddly has been bereft.
First of all, I think we agree about that.
Okay.
I mean, McConnell basically at a certain point said, you're hurting more than you're helping. And you know, the way that you whip legislation is not that kind of posturing that you're talking about, right? You call individual legislators in, or congressmen or congresswomen in, and say, if you don't give me this, I won't give you that. I mean, presidents have been breaking arms that way for years. You have your people up on the Hill breaking arms. You're right. He substituted theater that kind of – I mean, you're talking about substance and policy. That, to me, that's pie in the sky. I will probably never get there. But presidents typically, when they want something passed, they know how to break arms and get concessions out of people, and I don't think he has that kind of operation.
Well, I will say, if we want to turn to health care now and what didn't happen with the health care vote, of course, a lot was made about John McCain's vote. A little less was made about Lisa Murkowski or Susan Collins and the votes that they took to turn down the last version of GOP repeal if not replace. Today, Dan, we're hearing about Lamar Alexander from Tennessee trying to get together new legislation that's passed through a committee process that's actually something a little bit more like what a Jeff Flake or John McCain have been talking about. The standard way that we might do legislation that might actually help get people health coverage as opposed to the administration's stated policy, which is blow up Obamacare even more than it's blowing up itself and let people fend for themselves.
Well, you mean we're going to actually see a markup in 2017? I don't think we've seen one. I don't think we've seen a bill raised.
Yeah.
I haven't heard about this. This is something new. To me and to my way of looking at it, the only way to approach healthcare reform is through cost reform, and that is not price reform, which is all anybody's talking about on both sides. Both the Democrats and the Republicans are talking about who's going to cover the $3.7 trillion cost of healthcare. Is it going to be a tax on medical devices? Is it going to be a tax on the insurers? Are the insurers going to get money back in order to give subsidies? That's what the CSRs are all about. Who's going to pay? And it's not about who's going to pay. It's never going to be fixed by deciding who's going to pay because there isn't enough money to pay. The only way it works is by taking cost out. And I'd like to see whether Lamar Alexander has the idea that let's go after the underlying cost of healthcare. And if he doesn't, there's no such thing as reform.
Of course, the fact that we don't know anything about what the ACA or its replacement is going to look like, it's causing real problems for people, Christine. I mean, as we were talking about before the program, it's not just at the state level where there's an awful lot of uncertainty, which we'll get into in a little bit about the state budget, but there's an awful lot of uncertainty about the healthcare system that Americans are going to live under. And that has real consequences as households like all of ours try to make decisions.
It definitely has real consequences. And I think that people are concerned about this. And I think that that was the fundamental problem of what the Republicans were trying to pitch. You know, it wasn't about health care. It was about tearing down or ripping down something that, you know, Obama had put in place. There wasn't any sort of goal to, you know, the goal of the Affordable Care Act was to make sure that people had coverage, affordable coverage that, you know, they could actually go use health care. And I think that, you know, health care is a really big part of everybody's home personal budget and finances, and not knowing what's going to happen with that. So in Connecticut, basically the insurance companies, the two insurance companies we have left on the exchange, ConnectiCare and Anthem, will get a chance if Trump tweets that he's taking away these cost-sharing reductions, which 48,000 Connecticut people get, then they're allowed to go back to the insurance department and refile their rates. So obviously rates would be increasing for a majority of the population. And even people, you know, this will impact, it impacts the individual market. So people are probably scurrying to get out of the individual market, but it's going to impact employer-sponsored care too.
Everything that Christine just said actually reflects back on what Danny just said too, just in the sense that our entire healthcare system is done through that kind of pushing and pulling. One thing goes up, another thing goes down. So when you get to the question of, first of all, let's just say that the efforts to repeal the ACA will not stop or substitute something or do something that is a massive, in their view, course correction to the ACA will not stop as long as the Republicans have majorities in Congress. Donald Trump didn't start this, right? We have to not forget this. The Republicans spent 6 years trying, you know, introducing, you know, resolution after resolution, trying to repeal the ACA. This has been on their radar screen long before Captain Ahab showed up about this. I think Dan's right that cost control is essential, but cost control is a really, really complicated thing. You can't announce that you're going to do that on Tuesday and get it done, you know, by next week. It's really hard. I know this is not a conversation about healthcare, but the best book about this is An American Sickness by Elizabeth Rosenthal. Run out and get it. But, you know, a typical MRI bill might be through $3,470. That's for a group out in Arizona. Just in the same way that you're describing ways in which costs shift around, if Medicare and Medicaid, if they won't reimburse at that rate, then typically the providers just jack up the rate on the private patients. The private patients, because they don't really know what's being paid because they're insured, tend not to object to that. But the real question is, what does an MRI really cost? Well, in Japan, where the price for tests is determined by a panel of doctors, economists, and policymakers, an MRI costs $160. Now, things are really expensive in Japan. If you've ever been to Japan, it's not a cheap place. But an MRI is $160.
Wow.
They have the most advanced machines, and that doesn't include the radiologists $45 fee. So if you want to control costs, look at other countries. Almost any civilized, developed Western nation is doing a better job of controlling costs than the United States because we don't have a system in place anywhere except for Medicare and Medicaid that can control costs. And they do a reasonably good job, but then just the rates go up in some other sector.
We were all paying for it anyway.
Right.
Well, they either set cost, as in the Japanese and German models, or they limit access, as in the Canadian and British models, and they have to do something, and we have to do something. We can't. We have this technology, this coming up on $4 trillion machine, which is 16% of the U.S. economy, that we can't afford to use to its full and right. moral extent.
People
and
that, get more MRIs,
right?
Than they
right,
need.
And yet healthcare is a moral imperative. And so that's the big clash here. The problem with controlling costs is it's not just about making things more efficient. It's about taking money out of the pockets of some people who are overpaid in the health system, and that's the problem.
I'll just say, when we talk in the next segment a bit about Jeff Flake's new book and some of the things he's saying about the GOP, perhaps part of the argument though that is holding back conservatives on this issue is a profound disagreement with what you just said, Danny, which is that there's a moral imperative to health care. There is a real question amongst large swaths of America about whether or not that is true, whether or not there is a moral imperative to health care, whether or not it's a right or something that you should buy if you have the money to do so.
Well, that's right. But to the extent that we're a representative democracy, we're sort of coming to the end of that discussion with the reaction to the Republican attempts to repeal specifically the Medicaid reimbursement to the states. And that's really where it was at as far as ensuring lower income people. I think the popular response to that is that it's not an all the way imperative. You can get anything you want anytime you want, but that general baseline health care is viewed by American public as a right.
Although, can I just say one thing about that too? Not to make this a long back and forth between me and Danny, but I agree that it is a moral imperative. But you know, I did this thing down Sunday down in New Haven with Al Franken, and at a certain point I said, well, you know, single payer is now polling at 60%. Why is it politically hard to pass something that has 60% voter approval? And he said, well, you know, you're conveniently omitting the fact that Republicans have control of both houses of Congress. And the other thing he didn't say is that the insurance companies are really good at lobbying, too. I mean, they sit on these members of Congress and make sure that things don't happen that they don't want. There are other interested parties also who have very powerful lobbying interests. That's the other reason that a politically essentially popular idea can't fly.
And just quickly getting to that point and bringing it back home here, a Hartford-based Aetna hit with a shareholder lawsuit this week accusing its board of directors of breaching its fiduciary duties to the company and its shareholders by making false statements about the insurer's reasons for pulling out of exchanges in 11 states. Danny, we've talked about this before on the show. Colin has written about this again. It seems as though when Aetna pulled out of these marketplaces, it wasn't because of the cost. It was in a peak of anger, in part because of the regulatory authority that the U.S. government had over their merger with Humana.
You know what's amazing is that was less than a year ago. And it just seems like so much has happened since then.
You were talking about Joe Cohen.
Come on. In the original, Joe might be listening.
Tell me about the passage of time.
In
that
the
was
original,
really weird.
Yes, it's true. In the original statement by Aetna, there was room for disagreement about what they meant. There was room for them to interpret what they said as being not, if we don't get this merger with Humana, we're going to pull up second base and go home, but rather, if we don't get this, we're going to have to institute cost controls, which include that. It was the judge in the case, which the ruling came in January, that found emails that showed the sort of pointing to duplicity by Aetna, and that's what the shareholder lawsuit is about. And I think what that tells you is that, you know, look, these companies are going to play hardball, and we think they're playing hardball behind the scenes now. And in some cases, that's actually reining in abuses. I shouldn't say abuses. Reining in what some of us think are extreme policy measures on the far right. Specifically on the environment and on healthcare. And so it may in part be a moderating influence, the fact that companies like Aetna are doing what they're doing.
I want to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about a GOP senator taking on his own party, what that means not only at the national level, but also here in Connecticut. We're also going to talk about what is or is not happening at the state capitol. Finally, a deal on union concessions. Now it's just a matter of getting together on a state budget. We'll look at the impact that that's having to actual real people who live in Connecticut with Dan Haar from the Hartford Courant, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking this week with Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief at ctnewsjunkie.com, Dan Haar, who writes column for The Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
Well, we sometimes think of our show as the show of last resort, where we'll do shows that nobody else in public radio in America will do. We did a show last year about Pana Krom. She was a young Cambodian immigrant girl who, while in high school, became pregnant, didn't tell her family, didn't tell anybody, and panicked. She gave birth to her baby and drowned the baby in a toilet. It's called neonaticide. She went to prison with a pretty stiff sentence. When she got out, she actually came and talked to us, as well as other people who feel as though this whole phenomenon is not well understood, probably overpunished and understood. So we're rerunning it again. One reason we're doing this, we were lucky enough to win an award that John has won with Where We Live many times from the Public Radio News Directors. So we won that this year for this show, so we thought we would share it again. It's not a easy show to listen to, but...
But yeah, and this again, won a big national award, and it's very much worth a listen today on the Colin McEnroe Show. I hope you can. Jeff Flake, the Arizona senator, of course, we've talked about the other Arizona senator, John McCain, and his thumbs-down vote on health care. Jeff Flake has a new book out that he's kind of been writing in secret. He was interviewed on NPR earlier this week. Let's listen to a bit of what he said.
I'm very troubled about where the Republican Party is now. It seems that we've been compromised, but this time by different forces, those of populism and protectionism, isolationism, xenophobia. And I'm concerned about how we remain a governing party with those principles.
I'd love to get everyone's take on a bit of what we heard from Jeff Flake on NPR, what he wrote, an excerpt from his book in Politico this week, and bring it not only to the national level, but also here in Connecticut, Christine. When we hear Jeff Flake talking about his party, the Republican Party, flailing a bit, being responsible in some ways for what ended up happening with Donald Trump becoming president, it seems like he's not just talking about senators in Washington. It sounds like he's talking about the party as a whole. And I know that at the local level, at the statewide level, that plays out as well. Here are a whole bunch of Republicans who have some very clear conservative values, maybe that are different from some people who serve in Washington, but they are fighting an uphill battle here at the state level and also fighting an uphill battle trying to figure out how to get reelected in 2018 at a time when their party seems to be, as Flake says, flailing a bit to figure out what it's all about.
Yeah, I don't think that they're... I think there's maybe one Trump sticker on one car at the state capitol, and that's about it. They are not I don't believe that they feel that Trump represents the Republican Party that they know, obviously not Northeast Republicans. And I feel that there is an ability to separate yourself from Trump, and I think that they've done that very well, and that he's not going to be a big— Democrats are obviously going to try to tie local Republicans who are running for office and re-election in 2018 to Trump. I don't see that they're going to be able to do that with any success, because I feel like Trump is so separate from the Republican Party. He's such a personality unto himself that it's very easy to separate him and the party and say that, you know, they are two separate things.
I will say, though, I get regular emails from the actual Connecticut GOP, the Republican Party, and those seem to have a different tone than the tone of the people that you're talking about who've actually been elected. J.R. Romano sends out an awful lot of things that sound like they're not too terribly out of place within a Trumpian administration.
Yeah, no, I would say that I guess the Connecticut Republican Party needs money from the larger Republican Party, and so it kind of takes this line. And I would say that there are some people within the Republican Party that do embrace Trump and how he represents the Republican Party as opposed to how they represent the
and
Republican
one of them
Party.
Is J.R. Romano.
And one of them is J.R. Romano.
And the guy who heads the thing up, J.R. Romano, is one of those people.
He came to his position more or less as a populist. And I think you have to be careful here with gradations. J.R. Romano, although he's a populist and Trump is a populist, he hasn't necessarily defended Trump. What they're going to try
he
and
has.
Yes, he has. Yes, over and over again.
No. No. He hasn't defended his behavior, is what I meant to say. No one is defending Trump's behavior.
The behavior from the...
And so that's the game, is to try and separate his behavior from his policy beliefs. And it's getting harder and harder because the effectiveness of this administration in the White House is tied to the behavior of the president.
I will say that I think a part of the Jeff Flake critique of his party, though, Dan, is he's not necessarily pointing at the behavior of Donald Trump. He's really pointing at a failure of the party to define what it stands for, that social issues, that going after transgender people serving bravely in the military is actually something that is a conservative principle, something that Jeff Flake seemingly has a problem with. And that's something that's different than the behavior of the president and some populists. That has to do with what the party has decided are actual policies that they should back.
Yeah, well, look, both parties are because we have only two parties, both parties have always struggled with the side of them that is populist. The Democrats have the exact same thing with reining in business. There are pro-business Democrats like Clinton, and there are people who want to obviously rein in. And it's the same thing on the Republican side. So that's not new. What's new here is that he's opening up the door to this idea that, hey, it's not okay to have this guy in the White House who's just plain mean and whose policies are just plain mean. And so what Flake, even though he only mentioned Trump twice in the excerpt, I assume he was the one who sort of edited the excerpt in Politico. I believe he was. The name Trump only came up twice in that, but it's giving, and that's why the White House is reacting the way it is. It's giving cover to any and all Republicans who want to step forward. And I think, Christine, you think Moore will not step forward, I think? Is that what you said?
To differentiate themselves from
follow Jeff Flake?
I don't know. There may be more that step forward. I think in Connecticut that they Republicans, aside from the party establishment, have separated. I'm thinking of Len Fasano has separated himself.
But I disagree with the idea that it won't hurt Connecticut Republicans. I think by 2018, if things continue to go the way they have, and of course, depending on the economy, if the economy does well, everybody's fine on the Republican side. If the economy doesn't pick up more, especially in Connecticut, those Republicans that have been identified with Trump are going to have to do more than say nothing. They're going to have to actively distance themselves.
So if we go back to, say, May or June of last year, there were Republicans in Connecticut who had to make a decision. It was clear that Donald Trump was in the process of sewing up the nomination. So can you be an effective member of your party if your plan is to differentiate yourself during the presidential election season from your party's nominee? It's hard to do that, although I think it can be done, and there are people like Len Fasano who have proved it. But people like Themis Claridis made a different kind of decision, yeah. And they got in line with Trump. Now, I tend to agree with Christine about this. I think this is, for the most part, not going to be a 2018 Connecticut election about Trump. It's going to be an election about Connecticut, except for the congressional races, which are not competitive anyway. So once again, that's meaningless. But I don't see that as being a gigantic problem for anybody. I mean, I suppose, for example, if Claridis were the gubernatorial nominee, she would have a little bit of explaining to do about that. But by and large, I think this election is going to be about the stuff that we're about to talk about.
But just very quickly, we just spent some time talking about health care. I mean, the Republican Party, as you rightly pointed out, Colin, far before Donald Trump became the nominee, had been trying to dismantle the ACA, had been trying to dismantle Obamacare. That is something that is aligned with the Republican Party, not just Donald Trump, and the failure of the party to come up with any reasonable plan to actually replace Obamacare. That's something that I think does trickle down at every single level of the Republican Party, including here in Connecticut.
Yeah, although Bill Curry said something last week that I think was true, which is that the Democratic Party also has to make sure that they are pushing. That's why I was a little bit disappointed in Franken. It's like, okay, we understand the Republicans are not getting it done. Tell us how you're going to get it done. But to your point, absolutely. And one ad I sent around to everybody last night is an ad for a Kentucky race. It's a Kentucky congressional race where the Democratic challenger is a woman, a former colonel in the Marines, a woman who fought for the right to be a Marine combat pilot and then flew, I think, 85 missions or something like that. It's a two-minute ad. It's probably a web ad mainly. The first half of the ad talks about that and how her Republican members of Congress wouldn't help her and told her to go sit in a corner and bake cookies and not be a combat pilot. The second half of the ad is about the fact that her mother's a polio survivor, and she really goes after both McConnell, who she's not running against, but this is Kentucky, and the congressman she is running against. And I think you're going to – Trump, I believe, is never mentioned in that ad. And I do think a lot of Democrats are going to run not against Trump but against the Republican establishment, against the people who tried to take health care away. And it'll vary from state to state what the best target is. But I think you're going to see a lot of that kind of rhetoric. And it might be a mistake to overemphasize Trump.
Quickly, go ahead.
I was just going to say that at the state level, You have two leaders. You have the Senate. You have Senator Len Fasano, and you have House Representative Themis Claridis. And I think that they have taken two different approaches to governing the state of Connecticut in this budget debate. I feel like Len Fasano has sat there and said, you know, look, I want to govern. And I believe that if we step up and we try to govern, you know, the voters in 2016 got us to a tie in the Senate. And if we show them that we can govern, we will get reelected in 2018. And I see that in the House, it's very different. I feel like it's more bomb throwing, and that if we continue to throw up roadblocks, or if we continue to offer opposing opinions no matter what happens and don't necessarily negotiate, that actually plays better for us in 2018.
I wonder, Dan, if that really is the distinction. It's the decision to govern or not to govern. I mean, part of what Jeff Flake is arguing for, and John McCain was arguing for, and maybe Lamar Alexander is now arguing for, is okay, Republicans, try to govern.
Well, in my
try to actually run the country and help people along, as opposed to the bomb throwing that Christine is talking about at the state level.
Yeah, I mean, in my job and in all of our jobs, we prefer to have situations where it's a hard decision, where you have to wake up and say, well, you know, look, that made sense. And that also makes sense over there. And one of the problems we have in amplifying what you said to start this portion of the discussion is that the alternative in both Obamacare repeal and the Connecticut state budget from the Republicans is something that can't work. And we can stand and Len Fasano who's a wonderful sort of moderating force, I say, in the Capitol, it can say this is what we need to do and this is what we need to do. The bottom line is that you can't take away collectively bargained rights in Connecticut right away. You just can't flip a switch. Everybody would like to make things be, oh, gee whiz, this is the way we think it should be. That's not a workable solution. And so that's the common bond. And what works on the other, what doesn't work on the other side is that, as Christine said in the House, the problem is also the Democrats who can't agree on how to raise $700 million and whether. And there's still a consistently strong side that says we need to raise the state income tax, which is equally unworkable.
Well, let's actually get to that. So some of the big news from the state capitol this week, Christine, is this deal. And if we're talking about partisanship, it fell very much along party lines here. This union deal reached with state workers. The vote had to be broken. The tie vote had to be broken by Nancy Wyman, the lieutenant governor. And so now there's this $1.7 billion deal with state employees. That deal extends some protections over the course of a long period of time, something that Republican senators were clearly not pleased with. What exactly did you see in this union deal and the vote that Nancy Wyman had to break?
Well, there's good arguments to be made on either side of this issue. And I think that people who ended up voting for it and looked at all the numbers and the data said, you know, look, this is a good deal. I understand that in negotiations, there's give and take. In order to get this deal and to get the concessions, in order to, you know, start creating a state workforce that has a hybrid defined benefit, defined contribution plan, and won't have any job protection, and is paying more for its health insurance, that we had to extend that deal another 5 years for the health and pension health and pension benefits portion of it. So that was the give and take. People really objected to extending the deal past, you know, the next three gubernatorial administrations. But in order to get the concessions they got, which will in 30 years lower our unfunded pension liability by, I think it's something like $20 billion or something like that. So, you know, we'll be getting these new employees in, replacing the old employees as they begin to retire. And in the end, Connecticut will benefit. But we do have a short-term problem, too.
There's so many things that I would like to see. Two things that I would love to see and first of all, Dan's absolutely right that you can't fix the structural problems of the way these things are arrived at today. On the other hand, I will pretend I am Keith Faniff now. You know, if you take your boat out every time and it springs a leak, you have to fix the leak right there before the boat sinks. But you, at a certain point, also have to say, why does my boat keep springing leaks? And you have to do something about that, too. So that was a Faniff-like metaphor, I think.
Faniffian.
Yeah, Faniffian. Faniffian and fast. Casanova. And so, ultimately what we need, and I hope somebody runs on this in 2018. In 2014, I suggested that somebody run on it. Nobody does. Nobody did. I think there needs to be kind of a blue ribbon compensation commission where we look at all state compensation and then say, okay, you're a state cop with 6 years. What does a state cop with 6 years make in Rhode Island and Massachusetts and surrounding states? What's that person's benefit package? If you do a job that has an analog in the private sector, how are you doing? How's the college professor at Central doing compared to a comparable college professor at Trinity? One thing I know is there's a tremendous amount of misinformation and suspicion around everywhere. If you ask a Trinity College professor, they will tell you that state college professors have all these kinds of benefits that they don't have. If you ask a state college professor, you'll hear that the Trinity professors make more than we do. So let's figure this out. Let's get this stuff on the table. Some state employees are overpaid. Some state employees are underpaid. It just goes without saying. Let's sort of try to figure out what compensation is in terms and benefits relative to other states, relative to the private sector, get some real answers. The piece of investigative journalism I'd like to see is, what's the difference now in compensation structure, benefits, and other kinds of latent goodies between a long time, a seniority state employee and a recent hire? Because talk about a caste system. There's like a lot of stuff that just got sunsetted in for those people who, the unions took care of the senior people and said, you people who are being hired today and tomorrow and last year, you guys are, you're the untouchables. You just have to live with whatever we give you. It's still, I'll say one last thing.
Yeah.
Which is, there's another communication process that has to go on. The public listens to this stuff and hears state employees going, but my pension is now, and they think, well, I don't have a pension. You know, like 10% of American working people, I think, have pensions, something like that. It's a really low number. And so the way this is going to be understood politically in 2018 is either, okay, we got some concessions, they gave up some stuff that they wanted in order to help balance the state budget. That's what the Democrats are going to say. And the Republicans are going to say, they still have better stuff than you do. You're paying for it. And until there's a really good communication process that kind of gets to a third point of that triangle, we're going to have a very rancorous political situation here. I'm now about to get like 9 million emails.
Connecticut is a bit of an anomaly in the sense that our economy has struggled for so long that the pay and benefits of public employees can't rise and fall because it's not the type of thing that's set up with a system, whether it's legislated or done through collective bargaining.
Right, and they were insulated from the 2008 hit, right?
Well, that's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And so whereas other states have, including especially our neighboring state of Massachusetts, to a lesser extent, Rhode Island, a much lesser extent, have recovered in respect to job benefits and pay of the average person, Connecticut has not. And so that's sort of amplified it, but that's not necessarily a fair comparison. We know from a study in Wisconsin, which is not altogether different from Connecticut, that the public employees who have a higher level of education tend to be paid less than their counterparts, especially lawyers. College professors is a different animal. And those who have less tend to be paid more because the benefits are a higher percentage. It's very difficult. It's easy to see. Not easy to see, but to the extent that you can see it, you really can't do much about it in a short term.
Well, and let's just remember that the reason that we're currently in this situation is because we failed to fund the pension obligation. So we did create these benefits and we've had these benefits, but the lawmakers who were in charge and the governors failed to fund the pension benefits for such a long time that we're in such a deficit right now.
We have to take a break in a moment, but Christine, let's just quickly talk about then the outgrowth of this. So we have this deal now, and now, well, great, we've got this deal. Whether or not people love the deal doesn't really matter. There's something to negotiate a budget around.
Yes.
We need to negotiate a budget, and the two things I want to ask you are, what is the process for that right now? And also, what are you hearing about the real impacts? We've been talking about this for the last couple of weeks. The real impacts of us not having a state budget that's workable as we head into August in school season.
Yeah, so there are some really real impacts. And right now, to be honest, there is no process. There's no process to introduce legislation. There's no process to introduce bills. There's no So basically, lawmakers are meeting at the state capitol and they're going over these documents in private. And so there's no public input. There's no public hearing process. And so the public has no idea what is happening and how we're going to get erased the $3.5 billion deficit. And so I guess going forward, school systems and municipalities are like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what kind of state aid you're going to give me. I don't know what kind of education funding you're going to give me. Do I, you know, delay the opening of school? Do I, you know, try to delay how many people I'm going to hire? Do I hire less people? You know, do I increase class size?
We heard from the mayor of Meriden talking about maybe having to lay off people midstream, Torrington delaying the start to school because they're going to save $190,000 a day. And as you said, in some towns, Christine, car tax bills, yes, something the towns need, aren't going out because they don't know what the rate's going to be. They don't exactly know how to deal with any of this stuff.
Right. They don't know how to handle this. So, I mean, is it going to be 32 mils? Is it going to be 37 mils? Who knows?
I'm laughing because, you know, I used to have this job at TSU where we used to have to do the snowstorm school closings. You know, I think we might have to do that now. Like in Torrington, there'll be a 14-day delay. And it's like a snowstorm in September.
I think Ben Barnes, the budget czar, has made the point that we should not assume that the towns individually have done a particularly good job of making themselves efficient. And if this forces them to be more efficient, then that's something that's good for the Connecticut economy. That's a side piece of this that he may be right.
Well, he may be right. And I think if you look at the towns, at the reserves that these towns have, they're much better off than the state right now.
Very quickly, Dan. But the problem with this idea is that it's like not telling a business what the tax rate's going to be and saying, well, you know, you'll figure out a way to make your books balance if there's all sorts of chaos around. I mean, towns don't run the same way as the state does. I mean, towns need to have some sort of certainty if they're going to be efficient, not efficient, run themselves so that they can actually pay their teachers and pay people to clean up the roads. I mean, this is something towns need. You're not going to force efficiency through chaos.
Even in good times when Governor Rowland was giving back rebates to individuals, which may have been a mistake, it was always a problem for towns because
which may have been a mistake.
Yes. It was always a problem for towns because the June 30th fiscal year. It seems like a simple solution to say to the towns, go to a September 30th fiscal year and let's have at least a little bit of leeway. Everything works when you have 1.5 to 2% growth, and that's what most of the country is seeing. That's what Connecticut is not seeing. That's the core of the problem here.
You know,
there's an impact too on families too, because it's like, oh, but you're going to owe that car tax bill. You don't know how big it's going to be, and it's not going to come due in the month that you expect it to become due. So you got to do a little bit finagling.
September 30th fiscal year, Colin. That'd be great. The budget won't even be done by then.
Right. I mean, you know, I mentioned
the state
this,
still stays on June 30th.
I mention this every time, but yes, all of the problems that Christine and Dan have just laid out are there. And then also, I mean, I mention this every week, but all these nonprofits that care for the most vulnerable populations in Connecticut, you know, all this stuff that's been privatized and outsourced to nonprofits and stuff like that, those people are scared out of their minds, and so are their client bases. So this, it's why they should have done the mini budget, just to put a Band-Aid on this.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to finish up some of the week's news. And I'm also going to ask our guests to give us one good thing that happened in the news this week or in their lives or in the state, because there's so much bad news. Let's find something good out there with Colin McEnroe, Dan Haar of the Hartford Current, and Christine Stewart of CTNewsJunkie.com in the wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, Dan Haar of the Hartford Current, and Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Just a couple minutes left. We're going to talk about a few august institutions in the state getting a whole bunch of money. The first one, Dan, is the state manages to come up with $400,000 for the Hartford Club?
You know, the sad thing about this was a $100,000 grant and a $300,000 loan to basically redo a bunch of carpeting so that the Hartford Club can stay alive. The Hartford Club has a great idea, which is let's go from our old model of having a bunch of rich, predominantly white but not entirely white male entirely members to opening this up to the 2,500 millennials that are in Hartford and all that stuff and making it an active club. But it costs money, and the problem is that they had a mortgage that nearly defaulted. And so the sad part about this is it used to be the very exact place where people would go to dream up ways to help the city and the state, and now our city and state money is even going there.
It's kind of been the sick man of Europe for about 20 years.
Well, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so the Hartford Club is getting money, and who else is getting money, Colin? But UConn is getting a $32.45 million in a deal with Nike, of course. Nike does this sort of thing, and as well as Adidas, Under Armour, all across the country. They cut big deals with big colleges. This is a relatively small deal compared to some of the ones that other big programs get.
Yeah, UCLA, I think, broke the record recently with $280 million. I think that was Under Armour. But, I mean, the one thing that I would say about this is it's once again a reminder that the people who are doing the essential wealth creation here, the athletes do not partake in any way. So ideally, they don't partake in any way here, and it would bother me. I mean, I do feel as though college sports is now a process that enriches a whole bunch of coaches and administrators, and creates situations where carve outs can be made for Randy Edsall's son to violate the state ethics policy, but still somehow or other be able to keep his job. And like the people, you know, I mean, not that athletes in college aren't really privileged, because they are in certain ways, but it's an awful lot of money that's not going to them.
Again, Randy Edsall's son can get a job. If you are a basketball player and you take a sandwich from a booster, that's going to probably wind you up on some sort of a suspended list. Anyway, good deal for UConn. They got a bunch of money. Hey, I wanted to ask before we left, because it's been such a bad news week, just about something that good that happened this week. I'll start with you, Christine. I mean, what's some good piece of news from this week?
A good piece of news?
Or something in your life.
I mean, you know, not necessarily news, but I think that a lot of people grouse about there not being anything fun to do in Hartford, and I think that there are a lot of fun things to do in Hartford. Last weekend, we went to the Carousel and saw a movie in the park. And tonight, for people who are interested, there's a free showing of Guardians of the Galaxy at Dunkin' Donuts Park. So there's a lot of fun things for millennials and others to get out and do.
Not just for yard goats anymore.
Yeah.
Julia Rosenblatt and Jennifer Yanko, two sisters who co-founded Heartbeat Ensemble some 15 or 16 years ago. I'm not sure they would both count as co-founders, but they're from the beginning. Last night had a party at Jennifer's house in West Hartford to celebrate their stepping down from the positions and to raise money, of course, for Heartbeat Ensemble. It's very uplifting because there are about 100 people there. It was a fundraiser, and there were liberals, conservatives, some very conservatives, and young, old, all races, and it was a great type of thing. And it indicates to me that maybe if an institution like this can both stay under the big picture radar and thrive, that's what Hartford needs. That's the type of thing Hartford needs, and I thought that was a great event.
Mm. Colin?
I'm going to just triple down on all this and just say, you know, one of my policies this summer has been just to make sure I get off my butt and just go to as many things as I can and just enjoy summer. And summer, whether you live in New Haven or Hartford and anything, last night I was at Finding Neverland at the Bushnell. The night before that, it was Monday night in jazz in Bushnell Park. Real Artways had this amazing Moroccan world music band at Creative Cocktail Hour about a few Thursdays back. I mean, all summer long, there's just been sort of fabulous stuff to do. And you just have to be kind of willing and affirmative and make that decision that you're going to do that. You're going to go to farmers markets and you're going to go to performances. Art Feldman's group, I forget what the name of that one is, but they're going to have Self-Suffice, the rap poet, at the Parkville CT Fast Track stop on Friday, I think it's 6 p.m., and probably some food trucks and stuff like that. I mean, just, you know, Hartford is an underrated city. There's a lot to do here.
And it's interesting, though, Christine, though, because it runs counter to this narrative that we not only hear about the capital city, but about Connecticut as a whole. Not just that there's nothing to do, but millennials are leaving, and it's high cost of living, and people are going out of the state because of this and that. And honestly, if you listen to a lot of the things that we talk about here, having to do with anything from the state budget to healthcare costs, people would think, my goodness, what a terrible, terrible place to live. But then the opposite is actually true in reality.
Oh, the opposite is definitely true in reality. You know, we may pay a little bit more in property taxes, but, you know, we get a lot of services for that, and we get to enjoy a lot for that.
The struggle is not of the lifestyle. The struggle is over expectations. We're trying to be a legitimate second-tier city like St. Louis, Minneapolis, you know, and so forth. We're not there yet, but the problem is expectations, not day-to-day living. Day-to-day living is there's plenty going on.
I always have high expectations for Dan Har when he's on the Wheelhouse. Thank you so much, Dan, for being here.
Thank you.
From the Hartford Current, Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief at ctnewsjunkie.com, one of the really good things that happens here in the capital city. Thank you, Christine.
Thanks, John.
Thanks also to Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
And thank you for hosting, Mr. Dan Gosk.
And thank you to our producers, Kion Wolf, our technical producer, Heather Brandon, our digital editor. The executive producer is Katie Talarski, and thanks to our ace intern, Carmen Baskoff. You can continue the conversation, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. Thanks for joining us.